Welcome to the Shaped by Saltwater podcast, where we host casual conversations with people whose lives have been transformed by the ocean and who are now working to protect that environment, the culture, and the heritage. I'm your host, Nate Beck, and I'm happy to announce today's guest, Nick Strong-Savetich, CEO of Save the Waves. Save the Waves Coalition is an international nonprofit that works in coalition with diverse organizations dedicated to protecting surf ecosystems. With their mission statement, to protect surf ecosystems across the world, and a philosophy that a world where surf ecosystems are valued and protected, surfing will provide a vehicle for coastal conservation. Save the Waves' goal is to protect 1,000 surf ecosystems by 2030. Nick, thank you for sitting down today to chat about Save the Waves. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing super well. Thank you for having me, Nate. It's just a pleasure to be on with you.
Awesome, man. Well, let's dive right in with the backstory. How did Save the Waves begin?
Yeah, great, great question. I think a lot of people always sort of ask, like, where did this come from? And you know, we were talking about it with the founder today, Will Henry, who launched a campaign. He had been going to the island of Madeira, which is out. It's actually a Portuguese island, but just out in the middle of the Atlantic, for a number of years since the kind of mid 1990s, and kept the spot very secret and close to his chest, as other people did, but basically an island chain with a series of really, really amazing big wave point breaks and just crystal clear waters, healthy ecosystems, amazing culture and food and everything. And in 2001, there was a crazy project to actually build a number of sort of seawalls against these waves that had been hitting the island chain for, you know, millennia. And so with building the seawalls and marinas and things like that, with this big grant from the EU that the Madeiran government got, they were going to destroy some of the best sort of big wave point break setups in the world, and especially one called the Jardim do Mar. So Will had been going there for a long time as a surfer and a photographer, and just felt like he couldn't see this perfect wave destroyed and the ecosystem around it. And he needed to do something, and he didn't quite know what that was, but just figured he put one foot in front of the other and do his best to sort of stop it. So he raised this whole campaign that was all about saving this wave, and sort of from that, Save the Waves was born, because he started to see that there was a lot of places where sort of the wave or the surf ecosystem was being destroyed across the world, you know. And it helped that he was he'd grown up in Dana Point, and had, you know, the same year that the Dana Point Harbor was built and destroyed, the wave killer Dana, was when he was born. So he felt like he never got to experience that wave in his own backyard because of that harbor that, you know, maybe could have been placed without destroying the wave.
Sure.
So that's sort of a brief history of where Save the Waves came from. And then I think we've sort of spun that again to not just focus on the wave, but focus on what you kept highlighting in your intro of the surf ecosystem.
Right. And how were you introduced to the ocean originally?
That's a great question. So I grew up actually in the state of Washington, and growing up, my parents were teachers, and my dad got a job on this island called Cypress Island in the Puget Sound. And so when I was very little, we moved out to this island. It's a tiny little space. And basically he and my mom were teachers for these kind of behavior delinquent students. It was basically an alternative to going to juvie jail, was going to this island. So it's kind of a outdoor oriented rehabilitation center for kind of folks that had pretty rough childhoods. And so they were teachers there, and there's no ferry, there's no roads. We had a car, but it was on the mainland, and we took a Boston Whaler to go there and back. So the first memories, which I firmly believe get kind of imprinted on us, so if you think about human development, I have two young kids right now, and you're just sponges, right? You just absorb everything around you. Everything is a point of data, and you're just taking that in whether you know it or not. And so for me, you know, going to the store on a Boston Whaler was my first. I moved there when I was 6 weeks old, and left, you know, later on when I was a toddler. And then kind of throughout my childhood, my dad was also a commercial fisherman in Alaska. So we were in and around the water a lot.
Wow. That is crazy.
So, yeah. And I think surfing came into effect because from an early age, I was a skateboarder as well. And sort of the ocean and skateboarding fused in this thing called surfing. That was really exciting. So sort of this early childhood thing with like a mid-childhood thing equaled surfing.
That's got to be so special to have so many early developmental memories linked to the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even remember them, I think, for majority. There's just few ones that I can remember, but I know that like I literally was outside for the first 2.5 years, you know, kind of in a stormy ocean environment on a real small island with, you know, cool farms and stuff like that. So I was lucky. And, you know, I live in Santa Cruz now and my kids sort of have that, but I'm sort of wish my parents had just kept on that trajectory of being on a small island. And so, you know, but yeah, that's kind of my ocean pathway. And then obviously, you know, surfing for a long time. And
right. And then how did you come to work with Save the Waves?
Yeah. So I was always involved, well, for surfing for years and years. And then in conservation, I did a lot with water quality and, you know, leading environmental organizations. And even back in school, I remember an environmental economics teacher who's a friend of mine. And he wanted to show us that ecosystems have economic value. And the best way to show that was from a study that Save the Waves sort of helped, which was showing like, oh, surfers are willing to pay for this ocean space. And the whole kind of concept of surfonomics was the thing that actually really landed about like ecological economics and things like ecosystem services. Like, hey, there's all these free things that you don't have to pay for that are out in the environment, but are really valuable to your life and to your economy. You know, things like bees pollinate farms. And if you didn't have bees doing it, you would have to like pay someone to pollinate all of your crops. And then your food would be more expensive. So what's the actual value of the bees doing that? The first way I learned about the ecosystem services or ecological economics was, again, like surfing, like it's Pleasure Point was sort of in the study that we read was valued at this much. And this is how much people were willing to pay to sort of go there. And so that kind of opened my eyes, one, on the value of ecological economics and putting a value sometimes where there isn't one, even though, you know, I think putting a dollar sign and everything isn't healthy, but making sure that people know that there's a value where they didn't see it before, I think is. Right. And then two, there was this scrappy organization called Save the Waves that was protecting the environment and using surfing to sort of do so. So that was kind of my first intro to Save the Waves. And then, you know, I kind of always just followed along with what was happening with the org, because I thought it was quite cool. And I was a fan of the Surfrider Foundation, et cetera, et cetera. And then I got to be good friends with Kyle Tierman, who was an ambassador for Save the Waves. And he and I would always, and he runs a podcast too, and is a pro surfer and, you know, works with Patagonia, et cetera, et cetera. And he and I would always have these philosophical conversations about stuff, and sometimes Save the Waves come up. And then when the executive director position came open, he said, hey, I think you should really do this. You should take a look at it. So I started to think long and hard about it. And that's how I got into the organization. It's like, I got the job over here. And then that was about almost 9 years ago. So been here for a while.
Nice.
It's great. Nice. It's an amazing organization. And I think the cool thing is just the people that we have involved around the world that make up this organization are just some of the coolest people around. So I feel really valued. I just feel the community that we've created is really super valuable, first and foremost.
Yeah, it's crazy you bring up the people, because I was on the website yesterday and I was looking at the different World Surfing Reserves and who's involved. And I actually lived in Portugal for a while and spent a lot of time in Ericeira and, you know, surfing Cochas and whatnot. And I saw Tiago Pires actually works with you guys over there, which then I went down the rabbit hole to see who else works with you in the different World Surfing Reserves. And your list of people that work with you is very, very impressive.
Yeah, it's cool. It's pretty cool. I mean, again, you know, it's like we got the best of the best of surfing. And I just think about the friendships and contacts that we've made through that work, especially on World Surfing Reserves. We have about a 20-person vision council that votes on each one each year. And we just had a meeting with them and the legends that sort of come up there. It's like, well, there's Joao de Macedo, another Portuguese big wave surfer who's become a good friend of mine. And, you know, Steve Hawk, that is, you know, was a surfer magazine editor forever. Yep. And Tony Hawk's brother. And, yep. And at this point, at one point, probably in the career, I was very intimidated by like all these names and these sort of heroes. And then at a certain point, you kind of get to separate the wheat from the chaff and you realize there's just some really amazing people in the surf community too.
Yeah.
And that they are, I just feel lucky that we get to interface with those types of people. And the list goes on from, you know, around the World Surfing Reserves. I think about our friend Andrew McKinnon, who gets a shout out and he'll probably listen to this somehow. And he's just introduced us to all these legends of the Gold Coast because he was there during the, you know, the PT, Rabbit Bartholomew, Micah Peterson era. And so, you know, he calls up, oh, you know, Nick, you want to come over to the barbecue? Come on, Mike. And I'm like, all right. And then it's like, well, there's Shane Horan and, you know, Rabbit at your barbecue. You're going like, how the hell did I get involved with this? So like, it just had a lot of those very funny moments or, you know, people like Felipe Pomar, who's become a friend too, who was really active in Juan Chaco in Peru, or Ramon Navarro. Yep. And, you know, down in Chile, right. we got to work with him a lot. And he's just, you know, it's pretty rare, I think, where you do get to sort of work with your heroes to a degree. And then, I don't know, lots of times I feel like you have your heroes and then you meet them and you're like, oh, well, this person actually is kind of an a-hole. And I got to say for like Ramon, like he is the real deal, you know, he's yep. a hero and he's awesome to work with and he's a good human, you know, and I think you get to see that sort of separation, which is really interesting. So, you know, we have a whole laundry list of just great people that we've worked with through the World Surfing Reserves and then on our board of directors and our, you know, employees and our close partners on the ground in these places is fantastic. I think that's what really makes this job so meaningful. And then I think what makes the work meaningful itself too is it is, you know, it is a coalition, and that's sort of the awkward part of our name. You look, you're like, Save the Waves Coalition. What is that? And, you know, we thought a lot of times about, oh, we just scrap the endpoint there. And then when you think about it, well, everything we do is with partners.
Right.
And we don't do anything by ourselves. It's always building a community or a coalition. And so that coalition part's really important.
Absolutely. And I saw on your website, so Save the Waves Coalition, you guys take a three-way approach: protect, steward, and defend. And mm-hmm. the first of that is protect. And, you know, one of the ways we do that, we've already touched on it a bit, is creating these World Surfing Reserves. So can you just talk a little bit about what your definition of a World Surfing Reserve is? What are the attributes? How are they created? Why do you pick which ones you pick?
Sure. Yep. Yeah. So I'll take one step back, and the protect kind of strategy is around creating protected areas. One, it could be a legal protected area, like a national park or a state park. And so we've been working on that, you know, aspect of the strategy in places like Chile and creating a marine reserve around one called the Piedra del Viento, which is around this place called Topocalma in Puerto Cío, two amazing waves. But then creating a legally protected area for those places. And then the other flip side of that, like you said, is and those are called surf protected area networks. And then the flip side of that strategy is the better known one of the World Surfing Reserves. So that program came together in 2009. And really it was to kind of safeguard the world's most important, you know, surf spots essentially. And so there are 10 of them currently. We select them on the basis of four criteria. So, quality and consistency of the waves, the environmental characteristics of the area, the importance, you know, and sort of local history and culture of the area, and then the local capacity. So, both the local support for the project, but also the capacity, enthusiasm to be a partner that can implement on the scale that we need to do that. So we have, yeah, like I said, there's 10 scattered over the world, two in California being Malibu and Santa Cruz. Malibu is the first one, three in Australia being Manly Beach, the Gold Coast, and Noosa. And then Portugal, obviously, at Ericeira, down in Mexico, Bahia Todos Santos, which is around Ensenada. So from the kind of San Miguel area out to the Isla Todos Santos, or, you know, that's kind of the big wave spot of Todos, or Killers, it's called, down to Peru and Huanchaco, down to Chile and Punta Lobos, Brazil, Escuadra do Embaú. And then, you know, most recently is working in Costa Rica at the soon to be 11th World Surfing Reserve in Playa Hermosa. So nice. I probably left somebody out of there in my whirlwind of different locations, but the process really is that, you know, all of these places come from those communities. So there's a lengthy application process that sort of evaluates those four criteria, but in a lot more detail, and then looks at the letters of support and the ambassadors they have on board. And so we actually only select one per year. And actually last year we didn't select any of them because of COVID.
Right. But
we go through this big vetting process that we're doing right now with the Vision Council that I mentioned. We weigh it out. We actually tally. So we have quantified rank scores based on all the sub criteria, and then a discussion about anything that's sort of intangible about the places. And then we select one application. And then typically after a place has been approved, Save the Waves works with that community to create what's called a stewardship plan. So they assemble a council or a committee called the Local Stewardship Committee, which is like a board of directors for the World Surfing Reserve. And then we create a plan. And that plan identifies kind of what are the sort of environmental threats to, you know, or other sort of issues within the World Surfing Reserve area. What are the kind of underlying drivers? What are the strategies and then actions that we take that will, you know, reduce or eliminate those threats? And so that's been really successful because it's a locally generated initiative. It's locally sourced problems and locally sourced solutions. And then we just help support that whole process to tackle those issues. So it's been pretty successful at, I would say, protecting some of these places from, you know, issues they've been dealing with for a long time. And I have a laundry list of things, but right. That's essentially how it works. Once that plan is done, there's a big dedication that everybody kind of comes and talks about the importance of the place and why it's so cool. And it's really a community pride thing more than anything. You see, it's like, wow, people kind of are able to stand up and being like, wow, I'm being celebrated at a worldwide scale for taking care of my place. And that's pretty cool when it comes down to it.
No, absolutely. You know, I'm a firm believer in people protect the things they love, and things they love can be a place or a thing they do. In terms of a place, obviously, you know, I think it's great that you guys are focusing on involving the locals so much, because they are the people that are there every day and they see it and they interact in it and they love it. And then, you know, using surfing as a vehicle, and it's crazy, you know, and I'm sure you've seen this up in Northern California, but down here in, you know, the Ventura area with COVID, there has been a huge boom of people getting into surfing and going surfing, and it's hard to get boards and it's hard to get wetsuits, mm-hmm. and the lineups are getting like crazy crowded, and everyone's, you know, all the old, you know, all the old grumpy guys are complaining about, you know, well, I remember when this place was so crowded and whatever, you know, but like I said, people protect the things they love, and surfing is such a great way to introduce people to one of the most fragile environments on the planet, which is where the ocean does meet the land. Mm-hmm. And I feel it's a great way to introduce them to thinking about coastal conservation. You know, so the fact that you're using not only locals, but also surfing, you know, to get more people involved to think about, you know, maybe some issues that are happening that need to be addressed, it's absolutely key. So what are some of the main issues you've seen facing surf ecosystems around the world?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, is people can't really get involved until it's personal. I think that's one problem with the environment, is it's sort of this abstract thing. It's like, yeah, oh, the environment that's out there that I need to protect. And everybody's like, yeah, yeah, sure, sure. But then if it's not deeply personal to you in your life, it just becomes abstract. And then the bigger the problems get, the more abstract it is. And that's right. Kind of like why climate change is really hard for people to grasp, is because it's not like a, you know, episodic thing that's all of a sudden, it's like climate change is here and it's too hot for me to go outside, or, you know, it's slow and it's complicated and it's goes and fits and starts. And it's just really too big to imagine within your own life, within your sort of like day-to-day.
It's hard to perceive. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that surfing brings all that stuff like right into you. Like if you surf on a daily or weekly basis, like you observe things very naturally, right? So it's very easy to see rise in plastic pollution if you're a surfer in the lineup. Like, I don't think anybody's like, well, the water sure got cleaner today. That's not, unfortunately, the trend. Right. You're pretty acute to seeing things like water quality. Yeah. So if the water is like polluted, you're usually the first one to know because you get sick.
Yep.
I would also argue that, and it is shown, like surfers also are acute sort of citizen scientists when it comes to, you know, like ocean conditions of swell and temperature and wind and swell direction and all that stuff, as well as sediment flow. So a lot of places are dependent on sand and where that sand is, you know, and so all of those are indicators for climate change. So we have this whole army of people that are actually quite in tune with climatic observations and how oceans are changing, right? So on climate change, you get different direction of swells. Okay, well, we just saw like a major storm event, like it was pretty abnormal for October, but all surfers were really paying attention to that. Okay, why is there this big giant swell in October and all this like huge decadal rain event? And then same thing with like sediment flows and what we do to the coastline. Like I know down in Ventura in your neck of the woods, there's, what is it? It's not Ventura Point, but just around there, kind of the river mouth and the Matilaha Dam, right?
Yep.
Those systems have less sediment because there's, I don't know how many millions of cubic feet of sand behind the dam.
Yep.
And so that would arguably change the waves significantly there. And I think people have seen that probably over time as a diminishment of sand. So there's lots of those things. So the main threats that we would see are all of these perceptible things to the surf ecosystem, or the, you know, the things that contribute to the wave breaking, the plants and animals that need that place for their existence, and then human health and well-being. And so really looking at coastal development, that's one big thing that destroys waves pretty easily or changes the ecosystem pretty substantially. That's accelerating. Water quality, so runoff and watershed issues, that's again a very easy thing for a surfer to perceive if there's contamination in the water. Trash and marine debris, that's again a very easy visual. We have the like famous Bali picture of the guy getting barreled with all this trash and noodle packets going over the top of his head, and Kelly Slater texting about how bad the plastic pollution is in Bali. Like those are things we see, and we're again on the front lines. Erosion episodes and sort of climate change. We're seeing accelerated sort of failure of dune systems, of cliff systems, and that's pretty acute. Like even in Santa Cruz, like there's bits of steamer lane that are falling off into the ocean that you drive up to the cliff window, you're like, huh, well, that thing fell in the water. That's a big chunk of sandstone. My goodness. So, you know, we're again observing. And then I think coral reefs are a major thing in the tropics, is that
we
understand how reef passes work, and the health of those corals are what makes a lot of those waves work. And when the coral starts breaking down, you see how waves start changing and are more vulnerable to storm situations. And again, they're both due to climate change and to watershed or water quality issues around sediment or nutrients online. Yeah. And then I think the last one is access, you know, and we see how sometimes limiting access also damages the ecosystem there. If people can't get to their surf ecosystem, they can't be part of it. And that's sort of our argument is people are part of the surf ecosystem. So that's, sorry, is a really lengthy answer.
No, it's good.
But the short answer is the six things are our website.
No, I think it's good to have a 360 approach to everything. But you mentioned one thing that kind of sparked my interest was coastal development. And, you know, coastal development, and it's a catch 22, because on one hand, you're creating these world surfing reserves, you know, like Malibu or like in Erie, Sarah, mm-hmm. where I was, and it's helping, but it's also like, hey, here are these great waves. So it's kind of like a tourism call in a way, kind of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there's an influx of people to the wave, then it's going to push coastal development, because if a bunch of people want to go surf Manly, then they need a place to stay and a place to eat and that kind of stuff. Yes. Have you seen that challenge of, okay, we've created a World Surfing Reserve, but now everyone wants to come surf here. So now there's coastal development, but it can't hurt the wave or the environment. How do you mitigate those challenges?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. That's probably one of the biggest challenges is, one, I think from the coastal development standpoint, like we should be exacerbating the threat. That should be part of our like do no harm mantra. And then I think two is that, you know, sometimes in these campaigns or World Surfing Reserves, places get more crowded.
Yep.
And that part, you know, that's sure, like say the waves could be to blame at some places that we made more crowded. But if we made them more crowded and saved the place, I argue that's a greater good.
That's a win. Yeah.
But yeah. You know, like there's other things that accelerate crowding, like, you know, whatever. Endless Summer 2, like how much more crowded this place has got because of a surf movie that right. just made money. Or Surfline cams, like how much more crowded do they make it, you know? And I think we all use those things, but they contribute to crowding. So, and they make money off of them. Like we are just trying to exist to protect the places. So I think that crowding is an issue. And as a surfer, like I'd prefer to have less people in the water. So I don't want to exacerbate crowding, but your first part of the question I think is interesting. And what I would say is the goal, which doesn't always happen to plan as much as we would hope, but the goal is that we have a very robust stewardship plan, which contains an element of a legal component for legal protection. And so okay. that's a thing across the World Surfing Reserves that we're still working with. Just because of the nature of being an international NGO and not having jurisdiction within local places, like we really can't like parachute down and be like, this is protected and we made a law. Like we, no international organization can do that. So the best that we can do is push, promote, cajole, encourage local jurisdictions to create, you know, mechanisms to protect those resources, the surf resources. So that's kind of our job, is to get that in there and make sure that it sort of gets approved and has some sort of legal teeth. And then the promotion, the tourism promotion becomes good for the local economy, maybe bad for crowding of the lineups, but overall as a societal benefit, it, you know, is a good thing. There's surfers that own surf schools. There's surfers that own surf hostels. But if that is accelerating development, then it's not as good of a thing. And I think that's our balance between in the World Surfing Reserves, they're all in drastically different places. So having that consistency in the approach is challenging because it almost needs to be tailored per place. And I think some places we've done it way better than others.
Sure.
You know, like in Mexico, the World Surfing Reserve helped get the first state park ever approved in Baja at San Miguel. So now that whole watershed will be a protected area legally as a state park. So there won't be building within that area, which means that the water is improved. The sediment that needs to flow down there for the wave is improved, that the open space for Ensenada is there, that the wildlife that depends on that corridor is protected. And so
I was so happy when I saw that on Instagram. And that's actually when I was like, okay, I need to email these people. that was the catalyst. I saw that and I was like, thank you.
Yeah. So that's sort of the goal, but I would also, you know, there's places like Eddie said, that was one of the first World Surfing Reserves. Yep. And the stewardship, I think they're working on it from a municipal level, but the stewardship has lagged on the sort of policy or legal front.
Sure.
And I think that probably went too far. You know, everybody has their strengths as a community. They went pretty hard on the marketing, which is cool because it's like World Surfing Reserve everywhere. And it's like, it's kind of shocking. You go to a restaurant and they're like, there's a guy with a World Surfing Reserve shirt on, and that's their uniform at the restaurant. Yep. Like, okay, you guys maybe took this a little far. but it's still like, we're like, wow, that's like the power of this program is that if that's harnessed in the way that we intend it to be and right. is almost everywhere else, that's really a powerful statement for conservation. And so it's just about creating the pressure and the tools to be able to kind of actually protect these places. And then the promotion is not at the expense of the ecosystem.
Yeah. So you keep bringing up steward, which I love because that's the second approach that Save the Waves Coalition takes. Mm-hmm. Steward, encourage community and the coast stewardship via the Save the Waves app. Now I've been looking at the app and messing around with it, and I'm thoroughly interested in talking more about the app, what it does. I think it's brilliant. So for everyone listening that maybe doesn't know about the app, hasn't used the app, that kind of stuff, can you give us a rundown what the app is?
Yeah, sure. So it kind of came from this, like we used to have this report a wave thing where we still do actually, where people would kind of like, hey, I have this issue at my surf spot and can you help me? Or if they didn't use that, it was like tagged on Instagram, save the waves, help stop this. And we were like, we're getting so many inquiries about these issues. And then it takes us forever to respond because we have to figure out how serious they are. And can you please send us some photos? Could you please verify this information? And it was very clunky. And then we started to figure out like, wow, we have a real big network out there of people that are actually looking at these places. So a really long time ago when apps were really cutting edge, so like 2014, it was like, why don't we develop an app? And then that can be the platform for our whole network and coalition to be able to kind of track these issues to the coast. And then we can work with our coalition partners to kind of like find the appropriate response or get it to the right sort of agency just to know what's happening. And so, yeah, we created a really easy platform with the support of some great partners called Valtech, which is sort of hilarious if you know that most of them are surfers, but they go by the name of Valtech. It's sort of like hilarious. I'm going to get thrown under the bus now, but they're an incredible organization with tons of pro bono hours. I learned how expensive app development is, but a giant shout out to Matt Morey and his whole crew there because they really helped transform this from like a fledgling idea into a real tangible thing. So we've got some, you know, great supporters of the Schmidt Foundation, Flotilla Foundation's helping us out. And so now it is becoming more of a thing. And I think it's going to really help our other programs as well so that we can kind of have this closed loop of like, hey, we created this plan. Here's the issues we're concerned about. Here's a platform for monitoring them. And then here's a group that we've worked with to empower to actually tackle them. So yeah, the app, just from the functionality standpoint, people can check it out on the iTunes store or the Android store. It's free. It's called Save the Waves app. We didn't get too creative on the actual naming. And it's simple. You go to your local spot, you see one of those six threats I described, pick a, you know, kind of one of those menus, take a picture of the thing you're seeing. So if you're seeing for folks down your way, okay, there is an oil spill. I've seen oil that came out of this thing by Huntington. It's reached here. I'll take a picture of that. Now we can see an expanse of like how far out that's gone. People haven't used it a ton because I think they were trying to keep people off the beaches. So it was sort of a funny platform of like, well, they don't want people down there. So we're actually not getting that much information about the oil spill because it's more like federal response stuff.
and then the beaches are closed, so you know people couldn't get there. But that's sort of the idea, is that there's so many surfers out there. Most surfers have a mobile device. It's easy to go down, take a picture, flag what you're seeing, do a little write up, and then you know push OK, and then it goes up to the web and it's displayed on a map, and then you get to see kind of what's happening in your area or what's happening around the world and places you care about. And it's a fantastic platform with a lot of potential. So I think that's an easy way for people to plug in and kind of be instantaneous with just like taking care of their place. And, you know, the biggest learning for me in doing that, I think we can mainstream it a little bit more and improve the data sharing, which we're working on the back end to do. And it's just the number of partners we have kind of included in now is just growing rapidly. But the number of places is crazy. Like we get posts from, we have posts from like 38 countries.
Wow.
Like, and it's just widespread. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is happening in Sri Lanka. I didn't know that. Oh my gosh, this is happening in Chile. Okay. Wow. Whoa, that happened in Portugal. Oh my God. And so you start to see all these issues that you would have no idea about. And for us, that's like a really interesting learning, is because then we can kind of share it with our partners and be like, yeah, we saw this. So it's a great tool for people to use out there. It's pretty, I'm proud of the development of where we've taken it with the whole team. And then we've also sweetened the deal and incentivized it for people that do kind of run orgs or with partners, is that we're running a campaign right now called the Dirty Wave Challenge, where you can take a picture and submit it in that campaign. And if you make the case for tackling the issue, will provide a grant to your organization for $5,000 and just kind of help support to solve that problem. Nice. So yeah, we've done it once before, and it was kind of a cool learning opportunity and a great, you know, we saw a great outcome in Fiji that was to kind of clean up an area on the south side of Suva and make a wave down there just better and kind of tackle some of the trash and erosion issues. So it does work, and the money does flow to kind of help on these stewardship projects.
Nice. That's awesome. And then the last one of your three-way approach is defend. Mm-hmm. And you stayed on the website, defend, mount international campaigns to defend threatened surf ecosystems and inspire the public to take action. Obviously the app is a great way the public can take action. But what do you see as the top threatened surf ecosystems right now moving into 2022, 2023-ish?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think we're seeing, in some places, seeing coastal development accelerate, like in the Maldives. They had like 20 different waves that were going to be lost. So we were working on a campaign, which they had apparently come up with this campaign name a long time ago, but it was Save Our Waves Maldives. So Save the Waves partnered with Save Our Waves to promote the campaign of protecting waves in the Maldives from chickens to a number of other waves. And they're just the growth and the sort of tourism. Again, this goes back to your tourism question, but just people sort of building hotels and breakwaters and things like that without an eye for the ecosystem and the surf resources there. It's pretty shocking. Like, you would take this thing that people pay thousands of dollars to go on vacation to float around and ride on, and you're just going to build a hotel on top of that when people could come and stay at your hotel and it would be a value add. It doesn't make any sense. Right. Like, so there's things that are like trade-offs in the environmental world about like, well, this could be that gain and this could be this gain. And that's just kind of like poorly informed decision-making. So I think that's where the sort of shocking, and that Maldives especially has a sort of triple threat of they've got this like super accelerated development happening, especially on waves. They've got like tons of plastic waste that sort of comes from everywhere, and then not a lot of means to sort of dispose of it, not a lot of land to dispose of it on. So it comes from the sea as well as like domestic consumption from tourism. And then the third thing is that they're like like the mean elevation is like 4 feet on these islands. So they're incredibly vulnerable to sea level rise and erosion.
Yeah, that'll
climate change. So they kind of got this like triple threat happening all at once. So those are, that's some really threatened places. You know, and I think in general, climate change is accelerating a lot faster than we had all bargained for.
It's definitely,
and that is something that I think we've started to see the data on. Is like in California, you know, the paper from our good friend Dan Reinemann came out a few years ago that was kind of predicting like, well, about 5% of the surf spots in California are going to get better with climate change, and about 35% are going to get worse or completely destroyed.
Right.
So that's kind of a sobering thing to look forward and be like, oh, wow, this is accelerating. So in terms of like a place, yes, there's a lot of places, but in terms of a topic, I think climate is that sort of like the forefront of what we need to contend with.
Yep.
And how we adapt to it. Cause there's a couple of ways that we can adapt to it. There's sort of like, okay, well, sea level is rising and we have infrastructure, let's just protect it. So build this wall. And then again, it goes back to what I was saying about sort of the Maldives or the origin of Save the Waves. Like people just built on top of surf spots because they didn't value them at all. And they didn't realize that it contained a whole culture, a whole economy, a bunch of well-being for the local community, and this really important nearshore habitat. Like people just disregarded all that because they didn't have the information.
Right.
So as we're adapting to climate change, we can do stuff where we value the marine resources and surf resources, or we can do it where, you know, it's kind of willy-nilly, like, well, I just got to protect this road here. Let's just put this up. And I think there's ways to do it where you don't need to lose everything all at once. So that's sort of accelerated too. And there's places where, you know, we're going to lose surf spots because somebody's house will probably win out over a surfing location. So, but we need to be able to make those choices like as a community together in an informed manner.
Well, and I think it's interesting because, you know, you guys are looking at surf spots also from a monetary standpoint, not just an environmental standpoint. And I feel like when you're trying to pitch conservation to people, it's easy to pitch conservation to people that understand conservation and the importance of, you know, taking care of the environment in which you live in, but it's very difficult to pitch conservation to people who just see dollar signs everywhere they go. And I would be really interested to know, and you might have the answer to this, and you might not, I'm not sure, and it's okay either way, but how much income worldwide is made off of surf tourism?
Yeah, I weirdly do know that answer. A colleague of mine named Jess Ponting is down at San Diego State. Did a really interesting study right before COVID. So pre-COVID numbers of surf tourism worldwide are between $35 and $65 billion. That's a pretty substantial surf tourism market. The majority of those folks, 92% of them, of those surf tourists that he surveyed, are willing to pay for conservation and believe in sustainability. So right there, you have a pretty giant economy and you have a lot of people that are willing to value conservation. Weirdly, apparently the better surfer you are, the less you care about the conservation element and more you care about the waves. So
then the ego comes into it.
Which is, you know, I mean,
if you're focused on waves, you're focused on waves. But I think to some of us, it's the surf experience is more than just the waves. It's the whole,
deal.
It's the dolphins and the other stuff you get to float around with. And,
yep.
You know, so anyway, or that's just me covering up for being a very mediocre surfer.
that's just how you get out of surfing, like, you know, Strand. You're like, there's no dolphins at Strand. I don't want to surf there.
No dolphins. Surf ecosystem is not interesting. I think, anyway, so I know that answer. And then going back to what you were saying about like people that see dollar signs, it's really hard to justify like conservation topics. And I think it's not about necessarily like priorities. I think it's about language and how you process information, right? So when you're talking to surfers about a surf ecosystem or the hardcore, you're going to talk about how good the wave is and like, oh, you know, at this one swell, like it totally hits the corner reef and it just starts to barrel and it's really square. And that like gets everybody fired up, right? And they understand why that matters. But if you're talking to like a decision maker in a municipality that's doing public works planning, you know how many lines of text they have in proposals or work plans that say square barrels? Zero, right? You know how many budget spreadsheets they have? 1,000 of them. And if you don't have a number, your square barrel doesn't get on that budget sheet. So it's not really about putting dollar signs on stuff and how much does this value and how much does this cost.
Sure.
It's just translating it into a language that then is accessible because most people can talk about money and know what that means. It doesn't mean to say the value of a surf ecosystem is this. And you're like, well, you can't put a value on something that's so intangible and I like so much. Like, yeah, you can't. It's true. You know, but the analogy that I use is like, if the government or local government was going to bulldoze your home and put a freeway in, you wouldn't be like, my home is worth nothing because I will never put a dollar in the value of my family and where I'm hanging my hat every night and where my kid took their first steps. That's invaluable. You never could value that. You would be pissed and you'd stir up a fight. And you'd say, guess how much my house is worth? Yeah, it's worth X amount of dollars. And if you're even thinking about this, this is what you're going to have to compensate me for. And then that person would say, well, yeah, I guess that's true. Let me think if that goes into the budget. Oh, maybe we don't have enough money to compensate all these landowners for the value of their houses. But if you just did it on sort of this intrinsic value, you wouldn't ever be able to be reimbursed for that or have the government decision maker make the proper decision. So I think of that as like, do I like to put a dollar amount on my surf experience in the most amazing coastal ecosystem that's completely healthy? Like, no, I don't. And I don't put it on, you know, I don't put a dollar value on the experience that I have with my life with my kids of them walking for the first time or riding a bike or learning how to swim or any of those things you could do at your home. But if the city of Santa Cruz wanted to like expropriate my house, I would tell them a number. And I think that's sort of what we're advocating doing.
Sure. That makes sense. Absolutely. So looking forward, where is Save the Waves headed? What's next on the docket?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're in a really exciting point. Obviously, we set the big goal last year of protecting 1,000 surf ecosystems by 2030.
Yep.
So we're continuing to sort of add places under the protect strategy, under the steward strategy, and under the defend strategy with our campaigns. So we're expanding that. We've got some really cool stuff that just started to happen this last year in the Azores and how to kind of, you know, as you said, get protections put in before we need to like market that place as an amazing surf destination. So that's some of the work is protecting the surf ecosystems out there with protected areas. I think expanding our work with our partners at Conservation International in places like Costa Rica and Fiji and Indonesia. So that's very exciting. And then I think continuing to support partners always have in Chile and Mexico and beyond. And then I think, you know, you heard me harping a lot about climate change. And I just feel like we're so far behind the worst case scenario at this point that we need to like really think about what it means in terms of our work. So are we protecting a place that's going to be underwater in 10 years? Well, maybe we should reprioritize. Or are we building in things that would help that place not be underwater or under a seawall in 10 years? Then we should think about that. So I think mainstreaming climate into what we're doing is super important. And I think that the, you know, for what I, whatever, if there's controversy around climate, I think there's not controversy around losing surf spots. So that's more of the take that I'm looking at is like, let's figure out how not to have our mission destroyed by this like looming and growing threat. So I think those are where we're really headed, you know, is kind of working in the, and working a little bit more in California as well. And sort of the nexus of those places is what I see for the next couple of years, and then finding more ways to kind of integrate, you know, everybody that's listening, like whether it's through the app or a campaign, we really want to empower people to take action and feel like they're making a difference and actually be making a difference. So I just threw in the kitchen sink with everything, but, you know, I feel like we're growing rapidly and the scope of what we're doing is pretty massive. So sure. It takes everybody.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of taking everybody and, you know, calling the troops, how can people get involved?
Yeah. So I think going, checking out the website, seeing all the places where we're active, signing up to get our newsletters to kind of just keep track of what we're doing, downloading the app and monitoring like your own backyard and place that you love is good. And then obviously always being able to support. We can't do our work without support from folks like your listeners. So making a donation, if you, you know, if people have means, then obviously chipping in every dollar helps us expand and meet our mission. So we can't do what we do without our donors. And that's like a super important part of what we're doing. So I think those are, there's lots of ways to get involved and those are just a couple.
Nice. And then where can people find you on the web?
Yeah, we are at savethewaves.org and on the social places. I don't know what it's called anymore. The metaverse, I guess. Is it too soon for that joke? Will people not get it? I don't know.
It's funny you bring that up because I just read that article this morning. And I was just like, okay, man. Yeah, whatever you want to do there, bud.
I mean, I don't know. How are we going to all talk in a little bit? I have no idea, but metaverse
is fair.
You can see us on the metaverse at Save the Waves Coalition on Insta. And yeah, same thing on Facebook, or check us out on LinkedIn. That's where I'm more active these days. I guess that's not part of the metaverse. So, you know,
who knows? Zuckerberg might take that over too.
He may have some inroads there, but yeah, it's we're pretty accessible. We're out there, and yeah, I really appreciate all the time, and you're really good at posing thoughtful questions. And I think unpacking some of what Save the Waves does is really helpful, because some people just hear like, "Oh, Save the Waves, like sounds great idea." And understanding the logic behind it's important, because I think people can see how they can have effect in the places that they care about.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important to help people understand, like, they don't have to commit a ton of time or money or energy. And like you said, every dollar counts, but every little post on the app counts too, you know? And if everyone just gave 1% more energy towards this, you know, fight towards coastal conservation, it would mean the world to everything.
Yeah. It's just about continued augment, you know, steps going forward, just bit by bit, you make it there. And the more steps and the more foot, you know, the more feet you have, the more those steps mean on the larger scale. So I think it doesn't have to be a huge lift to get involved, but just continuing to do a little bit more
yep.
Will help us all, because we're going to need everybody.
Absolutely. Well, Nick, I love your organization myself, and I definitely appreciate you taking the time to sit down, chop it up, talk about it, and break it down really, and hopefully inspire some more people to get involved and take a look at what they're doing with their life and their relationship with the ocean and that fragile environment. How can we help be stewards to that environment?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the opportunity, Nate, and I love the podcast. So huge fan, and I love what you're trying to do with it. So keep telling those good ocean stories and also ways to kind of have people make a difference. So appreciate it, man.
Absolutely, man. Well, it was awesome talking to you. And that is it for this episode of Shaped by Saltwater. Until next time, go visit Save the Waves, take a look, hit them up on the metaverse, get involved, learn, educate yourself, be a good community member for not only ocean, but for also community. Until next time, I'm Nate Beck, and thank you so much.